Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor Lacaine. Today we're going to talk about leadership. Most of us dream of a world where everyone has a good education, a good job with a living wage, decent housing, and a retirement with dignity. Creating that world requires leaders with new perspectives and new views and new talent. Many had hoped women would provide fresh new leadership. We made great progress with women stepping into leadership in the 1970s and 80s. Women even rose to be heads of states in countries around the world. But recently, we seem to have stalled. Women are still under 20% of the U.S. Congress and have been stuck at that level for 20 years. Women are still vastly underrepresented at high levels in business. Where do we stand on women's leadership? And why does it matter? And what can we do about it? Here to talk with us about leadership is Laura Liswood, Secretary General of the Council of World Women Leaders, composed of women heads of state and government. Ms. Liswood is the author of the book and video documentary Women World Leaders, the most complete study ever done of women as world leaders. She holds an MBA from Harvard Business School, a BA from California State University, San Diego, and a JD degree from the University of California, Davis School of Law. Laura Liswood, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you, Eleanor.
I'm excited to have you here. Maybe you can answer our great mystery of what's happening with women in leadership.
Well, I'm not sure if I can or not, but I'll help you think about it.
Wonderful. In 1996, you co-founded the Council of Women World Leaders. Tell us about that group, you know, who's in it and what does it do?
Well, the group started, I'll give you a little history on it, with my asking myself a question about what it would take to have a woman president in the United States. Mm. So, since there is actually nobody in the United States to answer that question yet, I did find that there had been 15 women living at the time that were president or prime minister of their country. So I went about asking for the interviews with these women heads of state and government. And amazingly, I got the interviews with all 15 of them, and not one of the world leaders actually turned me down for an interview, although Margaret Thatcher did say, come back after you've met everyone else.
Pretty
sure she didn't think of it. Yeah. I don't think she thought I was coming back. So that's how it started. I began to hear so many familiar and similar stories amongst these world leaders that I suggested that perhaps they could meet each other, and they did. We all met together in Stockholm, where they created this Council of Women Leaders, and the president of Iceland, President Vigdis, became the founding chair of it. I became the secretary general. And so the council has been in existence for a number of years now. And if a woman is freely elected, head of state or head of government, president or prime minister or chancellor, she's invited to join the council. And so there are now currently 53 members of the council. The current chair is the president of Lithuania, Dalia Grybauskaitė. Previous chairs have been Mary Robinson and Kim Campbell, and Tarja Halonen of Finland. And so the group is pretty much a virtual group at this point, given how big it is. But the whole purpose of it is to raise the visibility of women as leaders and to try to create some platforms for them to have opportunity to talk with each other and with other women leaders about issues that are particularly pertinent to women.
That's an amazing story. And you mentioned as you were interviewing these world women leaders, you saw some commonalities in their stories. What did you see as kind of the common threads running among them?
Well, first and foremost, nobody thought I was completely off base by asking the questions about how they were treated as women leaders and what they had observed about that treatment. So it wasn't like I was saying to them, well, you have brown eyes, how, you know, have you been treated differently? Every one of them resonated to a certain extent with the question of, well, what have you observed of how you've been treated as a woman leader, and got a pretty, you know, overwhelming response around how the media treated them, how the scrutiny of the press was often on their dress, on their hairstyle, on their voice, versus on their policies, and that there was this over-scrutiny, and that there was less tolerance for mistakes for them than they saw as tolerance for mistakes for men. They all said that they had a passion for what they were doing because they would give up if they didn't have a passion for what they were doing, given all of this extra burden that they identified that was being placed on them. So that was some of the commonality of it. Many of them articulated that they brought different people to the table than they had seen men bring to the table, and that they thought that actually added to the decision-making ability that they had. Many of them came to power in slightly different routes than men leaders have often come to power. One was a school teacher, one was a theater director, one was a doctor, et cetera. And so it was they don't necessarily come to power in the traditional ways. In addition, a number of them, almost a third of them, have come to power after their husbands or fathers have either been assassinated or have been in office previous to them. So you get some that have been what is called a legacy leader. So those are some of the things that strains of ideas that I heard running through the interviews.
That's fascinating. And once you brought the women all together, was there ever a time when they all said, we need to work in a united way on a single topic, maybe helping get more women into leadership, or was it more kind of let's share information and support each other as world leaders?
Well, I think, you know, part of the challenge, and this is what makes the organization so unusual, is that many of the leaders are sitting heads of state. And that's really quite unusual to have a non-government organizational structure that has sitting heads of state versus former heads of state in government. And so if you're a sitting head of state, you actually have to follow the policies of your own country. And so it can be a challenge sometimes to find a unifying position on things. Obviously, we try to give them information so that if they want to take a position on things, they can. But we have to be very careful about that because of the differing government positions on things. Nevertheless, you know, they get invited to be part of meetings and events that are focused on women and women's leadership. And, you know, most of these women are pretty sensitive and aware and willing to engage in issues around women and women's leadership and other issues that have a gender, disproportionate gender impact on things. It's a pretty easy sell in that regard.
Yeah, that's good. I bet, you know, they probably want some more company up there.
Well, I think they probably do. They do like to interact with each other. There's, you know, there is a common bond there that they have, some of the experiences that they have. And I was just recently at a meeting where several of the current leaders were at, and they were still resonating and talking about issues around, you know, the fact that they still get over-scrutinized. So, you know, after about 15 years of going through all of this, we're still hearing some of the same issues.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. They are still over-scrutinized. You know, also, though, at the same time, that we've heard that from Republican presidential candidate Ben Carson thinks he's being over-scrutinized. So part of it may go with the territory, but I do think there still is kind of an extra edge of a woman having to prove herself, particularly at that high level of head of state.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever heard anyone articulate over-scrutiny on his hair. His voice, his
good
suit.
Point.
You know, he may be getting scrutiny for his policies, which, you know, which is legitimate, but I don't think I've seen it, that kind of personal scrutiny, other than perhaps a little bit of his speaking style. But don't forget, that's an issue of what one could call possibility and frequency. it's possible a male candidate will get some sort of over-scrutiny. The frequency at which it happens to women is far greater than the frequency it happens to men. So one off example, an anecdotal example of a man doesn't change the fact that this is something that will happen pretty much overwhelmingly to women.
Mm-hmm. Right, and we're still seeing it now. I mean, in 2008 when Hillary Clinton ran for the Democratic nomination for president, I mean, this thing, you know, guys in the audience holding signs going, iron my shirt, and the coverage that she got still about her hair, you know, we'll see this year. This time around, it does seem a little bit less. I think, you know, maybe that finally is starting to slow down and die off, we can hope. You know, you mentioned the co-founder with you on the Council of Women World Leaders is President Vigdis of Iceland. I found it very interesting that President Vigdis is the first democratically elected president in the world, and that was, you know, 1980. That's a living memory. And that she also was the one who kind of rose to be kind of the co-founder with you on this Council of Women World Leaders. What do you think it is about President Vigdis that had her be both the first democratically elected president and then kind of rose to help lead this group with you on the Council of Women World Leaders?
Well, I think it's a combination of, if you will, push and pull for President Vigdis. She lives in a country, Iceland, which historically, for the last 10 years that there's been tracking of this on the World Economic Forum's gender gap index, Iceland is always either one or two or three at the top, with the meaning the least gender gap. So she comes from a culture of social equality. She comes from a culture that really sees gender equality as an important and essential element to a good society. So, you know, that's sort of from her perspective. So, you know, wouldn't take much, and it didn't take much for her to, you know, also see that the rest of the world doesn't quite look like Iceland in that regard, and that there's a lot of need for, you know, more women to be getting engaged, more issues around women to be brought to the forefront, inequalities. And so she's been a strong advocate for this long before the council even. So I think she just saw this as a unique organizational structure, one that hasn't existed and still doesn't exist other than through the council. And that I think she just thought that was another opportunity to perhaps take her message onto a more global platform.
Oh, very good. Yes, and, you know, and 6 weeks ago, you and I were in Iceland at this International Women's Conference celebrating 100 years of women's suffrage, and lots of women from the Nordic countries and some great people, including President Vigdis. And we ended up at this private dinner where you were on one side of President Vigdis and I was on the other. I was so thrilled to be able to have a conversation with her throughout the dinner about her experience as the first woman president of Iceland, the first woman democratically elected in the world. She struck me as very practical, very smart, and very caring. You've known her a lot longer and worked closely with her. What do you think, like, what kind of a person is she? Such a unique person, really, in women's history.
Well, I think, you know, I think I appreciate the fact that you know, you observe those things of President Vigdis, and we certainly did have a good time at that, and it was a rare opportunity to spend close-up time with her. I have had a great privilege of working with her, and I can say becoming her friend. You know, she started her career life as a theater director, so she's really quite sensitive and aware of other people and other people's sort of emotions and views of the world. And so I think that background in and of itself has given her an additional, if you will, set of tools as a leader, that she's had that. She has that perspective on the world. She's genuinely caring about people. I think, you know, she's certainly beloved within Iceland. in around the world. People know where. And one of the things about Iceland, of course, is that there's only about 350,000 people in Iceland. So it's really nice to be able to know pretty much everybody. I always was amused when I would go out to dinner with her or something, and you know, of course, everyone knows her, everyone recognizes her, and she, you know, I think people trusted that she would speak for them, and speak to their welfare and you know, to their to make sure that people really were cared for in the country, and I think people very much trust her for that.
Yeah, she did strike me as very trustworthy. She made what kind of shocked me at the time, a funny comment. When I asked her about her background, she talked about being a theater director, and she said, I'm really not political. I come out of theater. And I think that's actually really true, which is kind of amazing for someone who was president for 16 years, you know, from 1980 to 1996. And only left because she said, that's enough, I'm done. I'm sure Iceland would have happily kept electing her president. But I find it interesting that, you know, maybe it's someone who's not political, who does come out of theater and a whole other world, who can bring a certain sense and sensibility to a political office that people really want. And I think maybe we need to get more people coming out of, you know, nursing or teaching or other areas and then go into politics, you know, with that different experience with them. And I think that should be, it speaks to me of where women can really bring a lot of value added as leaders in our government.
Well, I can't disagree that I think having a different perspective like that is a valuable contribution. And, you know, she herself, well, she says she's not a politician. She's one of the best in that regard. And also don't forget that many countries, including Iceland, separate out the president position and the prime minister position. And the prime minister position is really the executive in the country. And you will often see that the prime ministers will have what you might consider a more traditional political background. In the United States, we combine those two. We combine the presidential, which is the, you know, being out there with the people kind of thing and doing the symbolic things, with the prime minister's position. So we combine those two. Many countries don't.
True. In your interviews with these women world leaders, were you able to identify what the major obstacles were that they faced? I mean, you mentioned the over-scrutiny by the media on their hairstyle and clothing and so forth, but what would you say were the major obstacles they faced and what you learned from them on how they overcame them?
Well, I think part of the major obstacles are still the sort of notions of the archetypes and stereotypes and belief structures about what a leader looks like.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, therefore, if you don't look like what the traditional leader looks like, which generally speaking, at least, you know, in the United States has been historically male and white historically and tall. So if you don't kind of mm-hmm. look like that, then you actually have to go about proving yourself in a slightly different way. Because if you fit the archetype, then you're assumed to have that leadership quality until you actually show that you don't have that leadership quality. If you don't fit what we would historically consider what a leader looks like, then you're assumed to not have those leadership qualities until you actually prove that you do have them. And that's a different mountain to climb.
Mm-hmm.
So for the women, they've always had to, you know, it's like the McKinsey study, which has found that women are evaluated on performance and men are evaluated on potential. So, you know, for the women, they've had to be able to show that, certainly in the United States is the case too, that, you know, that they have the strength that comes with being a leader, that they can command the military and if need be, that they can go to war, you know, all those kinds of concepts and beliefs about, you know, what a leader is supposed to be able to do. And so for women, you know, it's a different thing if we said, well, you know, really the best leaders are the ones who can bring people together and are kind of consensus-oriented, and not that all women are like that, and not that all men are not like that. But, you know, the tendency will be for the women to bring some sets of different skills than men bring. And that's, mm-hmm. and that, incidentally, is not just men and women. That's what one could categorize as dominant groups and non-dominant groups.
Right. You know, so many women feel ambivalence about stepping into their power, and they're afraid that people won't like them, or they won't find a husband, or, you know, just from the cultural conditioning we've had. How did these women overcome that cultural conditioning and step so fully into their own power as to be a head of state?
You know, it's interesting. First and foremost, about a third of the women were either single, divorced, or widowed. So, you know, there might be something there that says, you know, that they were able to surpass that sort of social conditioning kind of thing. Others, you know, came to power through slightly different routes than what would be a traditional political route. Again, the legacy leaders often came to power after crisis and stepping into a situation to continue the legacy of their husbands or their fathers kind of thing. So I think you're right. I think women often will have a certain amount of ambivalence because, as all the research shows, you know, all the traits that we identify as leader are what we consider male traits, and all the traits we identify as caregivers are traditionally female traits. And so, you know, so women, we ourselves have, to a certain extent, internalized that and said, well, maybe we can't be in that kind of position, or the trade-off is too much, or, you know, I don't want to get into that mudslinging that often we see in the political environment particularly, or I don't want to trade off from the family things. So, you know, sometimes women just say, I'm not going to do that. On the other hand, I'm not going to blame women too much on this stuff because I think there's a lot of cultural impediments. There's a lot of inequities. There's a lot of unconscious bias that are real gatekeepers to getting anyone into positions who comes from the non-dominant groups into positions of power. You know, because the dominant groups have a tendency to, you know, like has a tendency to gravitate to like.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, when these women were heads of state, did you notice, did they make much more progress in improving conditions for women, or were they struggling so much to keep their head above water they couldn't really do much more for women in their countries?
Well, that's a really good question. You know, it's not they're not struggling any more than the men leaders struggle. I mean, these are very, very competent women who, you know, have all the capacities to deal with leadership as the men do. And so, you know, to underestimate that, I think, would be probably going down the wrong track. But in certain situations, I'll give the example of someone like Benazir Bhutto. She, you know, she may have wanted to change the status of women in Pakistan, and incidentally, Pakistan's status of women is one of the lowest on the bottom. So she may have had those inclinations and wanted to do, and I think to a certain extent she did have those inclinations, but she had, you know, a religious, you know, organization, religious belief structure that didn't think that women should be leaders, so she had quite a bit of resistance there. She didn't have very many women in her cabinet. She didn't have very many women in parliament. So, you know, even had she wanted to do some things, there was a lot of constraints around her. For the women who came up through a system where there was more social equality, the Nordics, as we've talked about, or some of the others, I think the women have had the opportunity. They certainly at least, at minimum, will ask the questions about women that perhaps the men wouldn't think to ask. I remember listening to Madeleine Albright at one point when she was Secretary of State saying that it's not that she handles being a Secretary of State differently, except for when she comes into a room, she notices how many women are in the room. When she goes on a trip, on a, you know, when she went on a foreign policy trips, she would ask to go to women's shelters and things like that. So it's not that they act differently in their capacities, but they do have interests that will more closely align with gender that perhaps a male leader would or would not do.
Mm-hmm. Right, and we know some of the men are coming along who are very good on it too. I mean, I was so thrilled to see the new Prime Minister in Canada, Trudeau, mm-hmm. who, when asked, why do you have 50% women in your cabinet, answered, because it's 2015.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, like, good for him for bringing, you know, women more fully into the cabinet there in Canada. So when you've been working with these women, and you've done so much on women's leadership in many different areas, which we'll get to shortly, but what differences do you think women bring to leadership, if any?
Well, look, I think, again, I'm going to frame it more in terms of what is it that non-dominant groups bring to leadership that perhaps dominant groups don't?
Mm-hmm.
Because that which I think happens to women can also be a framework for what happens to other historically underrepresented groups. And so, you know, to keep it in that framework, I think, helps.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, some of the research around gender, you know, has shown, for example, that meetings run better, that you're more likely to get the diversity of ideas if there's some level of participation of women, because women will have a tendency to be able to read people a little bit more and what's going on with people. They'll have a tendency to be more willing to do turn-taking in the meetings, making sure that other people get time to speak and that everyone's included in things. But that comes from, you know, being part of that social conditioning that you were referencing. I don't know, because I'm not a scientist, what's mm-hmm. nature and what's nurture. So, you know, I'm not an essentialist in saying all women do this or all men do that, because that's not true at all. But, you know, because of our sort of social conditioning of needing to be aware of our environment, needing to be aware of the emotional state of our partners or whatever, or needing to not be so potentially aggressive because you don't want to get that social negative consequence of being too forward or whatever, you end up, you know, developing what I would consider a different set of tools. And so for me, incidentally, I think the best leaders, and certainly I saw that with the women leaders, is that they use the tools that they had sort of perhaps unconsciously developed as a woman, but they were also pretty clear about how to use the tools that more dominant groups have developed over time. So my real framework around this is that the more tools you have as a leader, that is, you know how to do things that the dominant group knows how to do, and you know how to do things that the non-dominant group knows how to do, then you're probably going to be a more effective leader. And so I think women will have a tendency to bring more relational skills. Not all women do that, you know. I mean,
mm-hmm.
women have a tendency to be indirect speakers, but, you know, I spent 2.5 hours with Margaret Thatcher, you know, and she was no indirect speaker at all.
Right. That's for sure. Speaking of which, I was curious with your close contact and interviews and working with these women heads of state, do you have one that's kind of a favorite or one that stands out for you in some way?
Well, you know, that is a question I will often get. And if one is involved in this kind of work with leaders, you know, you develop a bit of a more diplomatic approach to these things.
Right. It's like asking what's your favorite child, right?
Yeah, exactly. You just don't answer in that framework. You just don't. So, you know, what I have, you know, seen that that there are, and this is for men and women, that there's sort of the conscious leaders and the unconscious leaders. Conscious leaders are leaders that look at a set of circumstances and say, okay, how is it that I need to lead under these set of circumstances? Unconscious leaders are more likely to just sort of do something in an unconscious way because that's sort of their instinct and their gut tells them to do it that way. The challenge with the latter unconscious is that if the environment changes and all you're running on is instinct or experience or whatever, then you're not likely to be as good. You know, one could argue, I suppose, historians may argue this, not true, but that, you know, Lyndon Johnson, for example, really honed his skill sets on a set of domestic issues and really knew how to handle these domestic issues as both a senator and then as president. He hadn't really honed his skill sets on the foreign issues and foreign policy, but he was using the same gut instinct for the foreign policy as he was for the domestic, rather than saying, okay, what's the consciousness? How do I need to be consciously different in these kinds of things? And I just noticed that with the women leaders, too. Some are more conscious than others in how they approach. Some have more of a theoretical construct to this. You know, some of them are interested in the research around women and women's leadership and things like that. Others, maybe less so.
A very diplomatic answer.
Yes.
You know, when you're worked with the women, was there anything that surprised you in your interviews or in your work on the council that you didn't expect that women would say or do, but that arose?
The first thing I think that surprised me that I didn't expect to see as a common theme was the fact that almost every one of them, I'm not sure about the most recent one because I have to look in their backgrounds a little bit more, but almost every one of them had someone in their family who had been involved in the political sphere previously. And, you know, even Margaret Thatcher's father was the mayor of that little town of Grantham. Mm-hmm. So that I did not expect to see. But, in fact, a lot of them did have that background. And so that told me that they had a familiarity with it, that they had a little bit more of an ease with it because they probably grew up with it. I also call it the Uncle Fred theory. You know, if Uncle Fred the idiot can be a politician, I can be a politician.
That's good. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, I heard an interview with Senator Ted Kennedy when he was alive, and they asked him, well, do you think you're in office because your family is so political? And he said he had a very interesting answer, I thought. He said, well, you know, it helped in the sense that it made me think more about running for office and about serving in government. And if, you know, if you hadn't had that exposure and encouragement, you know, you might not have even considered running for office. And I think that's a very powerful motivator for some people. They said, like you said, you know, if Uncle Fred can do it, I can do it. It just brings it home and makes it more real, because I think a lot of people feel such a distance from government, they don't even think about that's something that I would ever do.
No, I think that's completely valid. And, I mean, I think, you know, he clearly had given it much thought, given the family that he came from. I think you're absolutely right. I think it demystifies what it is. I think it makes it familiar. It gives people have already had role models of behaviors, as seeing their mothers or fathers or whatever involved in the political sphere, that it takes away some of the unknown or the fear factor or, the mystery of it, of how this gets done. But I think you see that in any sort of occupation to that extent. You know, if your mother was a doctor, then potentially you at least get a sense that, oh, you know, this is how being a doctor works, and this is what that looks like. My father was a policeman, and after 9/11, I decided that I wanted to actually be trained as a first responder. And so I did go to the police academy for 10 months to become a police officer. But I knew what a police officer did because my father was for 30 years a police officer. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it wasn't fearful to me. It wasn't an unknown. It wasn't a leap too far. And so I think you see these similar parallels.
Yeah, that's interesting. My father was a police officer also. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
That it never occurred to me to get training as a first responder and to go to the police academy. Do they let people just kind of go to the police academy? How did you get into that?
No. You have to apply and you know, you have to go through the process of becoming a police officer. They don't just let anybody in. No,
right.
You have to go
once you're in, do they expect you're going to work, say, in the D.C.
Yeah.
police force?
Well, you go to the D.C. Police Academy, and so you become a D.C. police officer. And so I was in the program that didn't have to work every day, but I did have to work. So you had a certain amount of time that you had to be on the streets. You had full arrest power. But you had to become a police officer to do that. So,
holy cow, that's amazing!
Mm-hmm.
You really get quite a span of leadership experience there. Did you learn anything that surprised you in the D.C. Police Academy about leadership?
Well, you know, one learns an enormous amount at a police academy, and then one learns an enormous amount by being on the street.
Right.
With people, you know, you understand how, you know, you get more of a sense of how diversity works in the world, or doesn't work in the world. You get that. You get a sense of how important it is to be trustworthy yourself, because you know your partner has to trust you, and you have to be able to trust your partner. You know that you have to be very conscious in how you act, react, think, behave, speak,
mm-hmm.
Because if you don't, you can get yourself and others into really big trouble.
Right.
And so you learn to be quite conscious around the things and how to handle people, you know, and when to act and when to react and when to escalate and when to de-escalate. And you hope you get it right.
Mm-hmm. Good for you. Well, thank you for your service.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you expanded the council activities in 1998 to include women cabinet ministers. How effective has that initiative been at helping women share best practices from around the world? Or are the situations in different countries too different to have the sharing of best practices really be effective?
Well, in fact, the Women Ministers Initiative that we did, and still do, it was easier. Remember I told you, because all the women heads of state, the sitting leaders, come from different parties, they come from different orientations, they come from, you know, different governmental policies, et cetera. The thing about having the women ministers, you brought them together based on the discipline. So you brought them together as women ministers of environment or finance or culture or health. And so there was far more commonality of conversation. There was also an ability to bring them together during meetings of ministers, like ministers of health, during the World Health Organization meetings, et cetera, and therefore help them come up with some ways to ensure that gender was brought into the main halls. So by bringing the women leaders together initially, then they could go back into the main deliberations and ensure that gender was part of the discussion. I mean, just because someone is, for example, a woman minister of health or finance or culture or environment does not necessarily mean that she is going to be fluent in the issues around gender. She may or may have not had an interest. She may be too occupied with many other things. She may not know what the current research is. And so, you know, the ministerial activity, ironically, was able to create more impact in many ways because of the commonality of portfolios.
Wow, that's fascinating. Now, is that ministerial initiative still happening?
It does. It happens in various ways. Normally now we do in collaboration with other organizations.
Very good. And what do you think is important about women's leadership? You've done so much in so many different areas. What motivates you to have this focus on women's leadership?
That's an interesting question. One doesn't really know sometimes what motivates you. You just sort of get into it, just like you. I mean, you've been intimately involved with this stuff, very interested in it, and you sort of go, okay, how do I trace that back? I think, you know, I'm a lawyer, and my original legal practice was around discrimination law. I think I think there's just sort of this basic notion of fairness that's embedded in me and probably in you too, and that when you see things that are not fair, you react to them. I think it's also a sense that either from personal experience or just observing the world that, you know, women are not, you know, they've been disappeared in many cases. Their voices have been disappeared. Their presence has been disappeared. You know, their perspective, their import. And I think that's always been a sort of a fuel that's kept me going, to make women visible, make them full participants, make myself a full participant, if you will. So I think that's been a real driver of it. And it's, you know, I've been fortunate. I've worked hard, and I've been fortunate in being able to do some of these things that helped me, you know, get my voice and other people's voices a little more visibility, et cetera. And, you know, we still see that. The introduction, you indicated how slow progress has been.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that continues to fuel, again, people like you and me. You know, why is this progress so slow? Leadership, you know, countries, you know, women are entitled to be leaders just like men are entitled to be leaders. Women are entitled to have, you know, full due within a society and in a business, whatever, just like men are. I mean, it's just that's my key driver here. You know, and women's experiences are different often than men's experiences, and how you can, you know, how you can actually operate a successful society, a successful business, or whatever, without bringing in all these different diverse experiences and thinking, et cetera. Because without that level of diversity, your innovation, your creativity, your solving of world problems, you know, doesn't happen at the pace that it should happen. You know, we know a lot about what would create change in the world, but we act as if we don't know about it. We sort of ignore it. You know, we know that if you give a dollar to a man, the World Bank studies, you know, that with all due respect to men, he'll have a tendency to use it on consumable goods. You know, if you give a dollar to a woman, she's more likely to use it for her family, for health care, for education, et cetera. Well, we know that. You know, but we continue to develop programs that put the money in the hands of the men.
Right, so, and I saw that. I lived in Africa for a while, in Tanzania and East Africa, and that's what the development people there were saying. They were giving the grants, some of them, more to the women because they thought, well, that'll help with the farming and with the education for the children, taking the food for the children. And they were concerned if they gave it to the men, that either, you know, buy some beer or buy a motorcycle or something. And although even knowing that, still so much of the grant money given out can still end up in the hands of the men. But, you know, you mentioned that your first question that started you on this whole journey was, why don't we have a woman president in the United States? And in 1997, you co-founded the White House Project to help Americans be more open to a woman president. Can you, it seems to me we've made some great progress on that since you co-founded the White House Project, that people do seem now much more ready and willing to have a woman president, with Hillary Clinton running now for the election next year for president, that she seems to have gotten a lot of support and respect from many different quarters. You know, how do you feel about where we stand now in terms of readiness to elect a woman president of the United States?
Well, I think we definitely have been on a path and on a journey that's getting us closer. There's no question about that. I mean, if you even look back on, you know, the Deloitte research in the early 90s, where they asked about, you know, could a woman handle a rogue nation versus could a man handle a rogue nation? And, you know, people thought that by seven times more of a factor that the men could do that. And then you get Madeleine Albright, you get Condoleezza Rice, you know, you get women secretaries of state, you get Hillary Clinton, the Secretary of State, and that gap is pretty much closed. You know, so it's those role modeling, seeing that women can do these kinds of things. So I agree. I think we have gotten a lot further. I think there's still probably some percentage of the society that will, you know, not openly, secretly believe that maybe a woman can't do it, but that gap is closing also. I think part of the challenge has historically been, and still is to a certain extent, but less so, is that we have historically gotten our presidents from the vice presidents, the governors, and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And, you know, there are very few women governors. There have been no women vice presidents. And now that the ground combat is being opened to women, will there ever even be the potential of having a female chairman of the Joint Chiefs? So, you know, those pools that we have historically fished from have really been very much excluding of women. But I think, you know, these days at least we seem to be more willing to look at senators, business people, to be as potential for the presidency. I mean, we'll see. You know, one of the things that would help any female is that if she had three or four other women running for the office. I often call it, you know, we need a few more self-indulgent female millionaires running for the office, you know, for the presidency. We got enough self-indulgent male millionaires doing it. And so, you know, for one thing, if you get more women in the electoral process, the press will, at least according to the Annenberg work study, will stop over-scrutinizing the women for their personal, but more scrutinizing them on their policy. And so I think that, you know, it would be better if we could have more and more women who are in the pool running for the presidency. But I agree with you. I think we're on a trajectory that seems to get us closer to this potential of getting a woman as president. And I think many of us are eagerly looking forward to that.
Yeah, it'd be great. And it'd be nice to have more women running. We've got Carly Fioroni running there for the Republican presidential nomination. She made kind of a splash early in the debates, but seems to have faded. But I think you're right. I think the more we have women running, the more it normalizes that's something that women do and takes it out of kind of the extraordinary, makes it a higher barrier. If it's never been done, it's harder to do. But once you're doing it, it kind of normalizes, and then we can get more of the women in there. Are you working at all on Hillary Clinton's campaign?
Not particularly. You know, I'm certainly, you know, hoping that we'll get a woman president. You know, being the, you know, I certainly have provided some support, but being the head of a council of heads of state, it's a little bit difficult to be fully out there.
Yeah. Well, one of the interesting things about you is that you've worked not only in the government arena, but also in business. And in 2001, you were named Managing Director for Global Leadership and Diversity for Goldman Sachs, and you're still a senior advisor to the firm working on globalization and workforce diversity. How is Goldman Sachs on having women in senior positions?
Well, you know, I really can't speak for Goldman Sachs. You know, I can look at the financial services industry and say that, you know, a lot of organizations are very focused on the issues around diversity. A lot of big companies are really focused on the issues around diversity. I think a lot of companies see the wisdom and need of having, you know, a diverse workforce that mirrors their client base, a diverse workforce that creates, you know, diverse ideas, stimulates innovation, stimulates creativity. You know, people want to get the best and the brightest people. You know, any organization wants the best and the brightest people, and the bigger the pool, the more likely it is you're going to get the best and the brightest people. So I think there's a lot of awareness in a lot of the industries now. I mean, there's still some industries where you look and you see, wait, you still don't even have a woman on your board of directors. How's that possible?
You know, right.
In this day and age, you know, kind of thing. So there's still companies who it's not really on their radar. But I think for a lot of companies now, there's a much more knowing sense of the value of having a diverse workplace and the value of making sure that women and other historically underrepresented groups reach the top of leadership and that you need to put programs in place and have measurements and have a leadership commitment to it to make that happen.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting. There are many more women in business now, more women managers, executives. We're still not getting the women in the very top positions, you know, the C-suite, as they say, and a lot of the board positions and so forth. What do you think the major obstacles are for gender equality in Wall Street, and are they similar or different from the obstacles to gender equality in government?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think there's still obstacles in both government and in the for-profit sector. I think, you know, there's the most current thinking around unconscious bias is certainly one of the gatekeepers about, you know, again, what we think about people, how we bond with people, how, you know, who gets good assignments, who gets, how, you know, how are people evaluated. I mean, there's all sorts of, you know, as I say, gatekeepers along the way that can subtly advantage and subtly disadvantage. You know, I think that it is interesting for the for-profit sector. I think often, you know, it's a challenge for women to get into line management positions. They often end up, you know, sort of being put into staff roles. Cells, I think, you know, Herminia Barra out of INSEAD has, you know, research found that women are over-mentored and under-sponsored.
And what does that mean?
Yeah, you know, well, mentoring is basically, you know, I'll coach you, I'll give you some good ideas, I'll, you know, bounce some, you know, recommendations off of you, et cetera. Sponsoring is when somebody says about a person who's potentially going to be promoted to a higher level or whatever, you know, I am going to vouch for that person, I'm going to make sure that that person succeeds, I'm going to be the one who, you know, is often called co-sign the mortgage. You know,
mm-hmm.
I'm the one that's going to back this person up. And mentoring can be fairly comfortably done, like to not like, but sponsoring is often much more comfortable like to like, because if you're putting your own reputation on the line, you want to have a sense of, oh, this person reminds me of me when I was young.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if most of the senior people are, you know, Dominant Group members, then don't be surprised if they're sponsoring people who look like them.
Right, that's very interesting. You know, it's easy enough to give some good advice, but then to really put some muscle behind, I sponsor this person for promotion, and that's really what it takes to advance.
Very much so. I mean, it's a key element to it, and getting the risk assignments, getting the good feedback on what you need to do, what you do well, getting, you know, some of the developmental opportunities. You know, all of these are the kinds of things that it takes to make a CEO. And, you know, you just see all sorts of things about, you know, who gets heard, who doesn't get heard, and how many times have you had women complain to you, you know, I said something and nobody said anything, and then the man said something and everyone said, boy, that's a great idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I mean, we hear that, and people aren't making that stuff up.
No, I've experienced that. I know that's true.
Yeah. So, you know, there are dynamics that are going on. You know, you were referencing it before about how some women are worried about being seen as too aggressive or something like that. You know, as I often said, you know, aggressive men bomb small countries and aggressive women put you on hold on the telephone.
That's a great line. I love that. You know, Vince Lombardi, the famous football coach, once said, leaders aren't born, they're made. Do you agree with that?
Pretty much I do agree with that. I do. I think that, you know, the Greeks said leadership was a combination of chance and genius. And, you know, Vivaldi said that the best composers, and I think he meant, and I think he, well, I think of it as the best leaders, have a cool head and a hot heart, you know, and these are things that you develop. I think we talked a little bit about the military. I think the military is one of the institutions that does train people for leadership, takes people who maybe have the desire and the energy, et cetera, and then helps, gives them the leadership training and tools and feedback that's necessary to grow someone as a leader. So I think I am in the Vince Lombardi camp on this one.
Interesting. And there are now numerous programs that train women on leadership. What do you think are the best training for women leaders out there right now?
Well, I don't know if I can give you a specific program name or whatever. I know there's a lot of them out there. But, you know, I once asked a three-star general, you know, about what it took to become a leader, and he said, practice.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, women have to be given the opportunities to practice, do things, fail, learn from their failure, do it again, succeed, get a bigger set of responsibilities, practice, fail, learn again, you know, all the things that it takes to develop your skill sets as a leader.
Interesting. So how can our listeners learn more about your work?
Well, thank you for asking. I've got a book on diversity called The Loudest Duck, which is about moving beyond diversity. It's the sort of the surface diversity that we sometimes get caught up in. I have a book and a video documentary called Women World Leaders, and that's available. Obviously, people can go on my website. I have a number of blogs that I've written, and you know, to see kind of my thought process on a few things. So I would welcome that from people, your listeners.
That's great. And that can all be found on your website, lauralisswood.com, right?
Perfect, yes.
Yeah, wonderful. Terrific. Well, that's all the time we have. Laura Lisswood, thank you so much for being with us today and for all your important work.
Thank you, Eleanor.
In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, go to thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. I'll be back 1 week from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor Lacaine with All Together Now. Now that we know.